Bienvenue au train des jeux. Nous sommes ici à jouer au basketball. Il va vous conduire à la victoire. Car bonne dans notre grand départ. Et l'esprit du bel an qui vit en tous les mans. Et l'esprit qui ne meurt jamais. Parce que basketball, oui, basketball a arrivé.
Jouer!
Hello there, welcome to BiscastBall, the Biscuitball Biscast. My name is Corbin Smith. We got an evening recording tonight. Everyone in the house is asleep. Man, woman, child, dog. So I am endeavoring to not wake them and speak gently into the microphone. Now I understand that this is maybe a more sensuous podcast than you're used to. You might be feeling some intense ASMR tingles. If you would like me to help you along in that endeavor. Let me. Oh, I'm cutting your hair. Oh, wow, you certainly have a lot of hair. Snip, 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 snip. You're welcome for those premium ASMR tingles. I normally charge people $5,000 to listen to my voice for ASMR purposes. You know, what you yourself. You're the only thing you own, and you are worth the money, you know? I'm going to now say a few basketball concepts in this whispery voice, just so you have them on file. Three-point line. Three-point shot. Three-point shot behind the three-point line off the dribble. Three-point shot off the dribble behind 3 feet behind the three-point line with 3 seconds to go in the three-second shot clock and 3 seconds to go in the three-second game. I don't know if you've heard about the three-second game. It's a new FIBA invention. They often end in ties. There's a lot of overtimes in a three-second game. Let's get straight to it this week. Our guest is Jason Mann. Jason is one of the hosts of the Over and Back podcast on the Hardwood Paroxysm Network, which is the same network that features this podcast. We both watched Game 3 of the 1975 Finals between the Bullets and Warriors, and then we talked about the game a little bit. So enjoy.
Hello there, we're here with Jason Mann. Jason is one of the hosts with Rich K. Krajcik?
Krajcik.
Krajcik. Oh, boy, that was a misreading. Of the Over and Back podcast, also on the HP Basketball Network. It is a basketball history podcast. And we today are going to talk about one single element of basketball history, and that is Game 3 of the 1975 Finals between the Washington Bullets and the Golden State Warriors. Is this correct, Jason? You have watched this game.
I have watched this game, yes.
And I just got done watching this game right now. How did you feel about the game, Jason?
You know, it's an interesting time capsule. I also, you know, for the most part, enjoyed the game. You know, it was a pretty close game throughout most of it, so it was kind of an exciting back and forth effort. To see sort of the differences in style of play, I thought were interesting as well. The different, things like the fashion, the way the television production was on CBS at the time. See some players that I maybe had heard of a little bit but hadn't actually seen that much. You get a chance to know them a little bit better. So it was a good experience.
Did you – one of the commercials was for low-cost long distance. And even in my lifetime – long distance existed, and I'm still stunned by it.
Yes. It is sort of a baffling concept now that I guess it's nice that the phone company sort of transitioned to the internet so they can take our money that way as opposed to the, you know, old system.
I'm almost completely convinced that that was that, like, it costing more to hook you up to a long distance provider was just total bullcrap, and it was just a way to get money, you know?
I'm not going to disagree.
I think the FCC should have regulated that a little more.
Yeah.
In the 1970s. So this broadcast begins with a theme song. This game was on CBS. And it begins with the CBS basketball theme song, which I would say is one of the goodest things I've ever heard.
It is quite amazing. I mean, it sounds like, I don't know, is Captain Tennille, is that like is that completely off as far as, you know, what a contemporary song might have sounded like at the time?
It's sort of this, it's a little bit funky, just a little bit, but mm-hmm. mostly it's very smooth.
Yeah.
And it's got, you know, it's got that crisp old-timey production. You know, I don't want to be a romantic about something that I never experienced, but like, you know, in the back in those days, you didn't just have computers. You know, you had to if you wanted to lay down a smooth track to open up your broadcast, you had to get a bunch of very smooth, very calm musicians in a room together, and you guys would just sit down and knock it out. And oh man, very nice. And you know, some little nice little art line drawings of basketball players. You got to see this.
Yeah, it was very earnest.
Very earnest.
Yes.
I think it ends with, like, we're going to see which way the ball bounces, which I think as a, you know, as a concept in the song about basketball is a very, how do I say this? Deterministic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't say, hey, who's going to Michael Jordan this? Who's going to force them over the line? It says, hey, yeah, we're just going to see what's going to happen.
It's not who's going to take the ball. You know, it's about where it's just going to go.
Yeah. Where's the ball going to bounce?
Yes. Really? Although the name of the game is action.
The name of the game is action.
Yeah.
But it's not deterministic action.
No.
We're watching a river. So, Jason,
yes.
Who won this game?
The Golden State Warriors won this game.
They did. Let's pull up a box three. There we go. Oh my God, this was a 4-game series.
Yes.
I have to say, I didn't. I tried my hardest to watch the game, sort of with the sense of not knowing what was going to happen. And I thought the Bullets were going to win because I just didn't assume that it was like going to be a sweepy kind of series. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, the Bullets were heavily favored. I mean, they were a 60-win team that year, and the Warriors only won 48 games. They were the top. They had the top record in the West, while the Bullets had were tied with the Celtics for the best record. Really, the Bullets and the Celtics were the only two teams that you would have thought looked like championship teams. Everyone else was way below. It's actually kind of a strange year in how the records were distributed. Like, there's like really like five above average teams, and everyone else is sort of in this morass of either not being very good or being really bad.
Do you know how many do you happen to recall how many seeds there were back then?
It was five. There's like a play-in, like five-game series in the first round, and then like a 4-game series proper in the second round, then the conference finals, and then the finals.
And
so
you would. About 20 teams in the NBA at the time?
I think 18 teams.
Okay.
The Jazz, this was the first year for the Jazz, and then the four ABA teams would be added in 77.
Absolutely. The first that was the year of the Portland Trailblazers. So the Warriors won this game.
Yes.
I would say the biggest factor in that was probably Rick Barry.
Absolutely.
Would that
yeah,
be safe
I
to
mean,
say?
Yeah, I mean, he was just all over the court, getting ahead for fast breaks and kind of scoring easily in transition, making plays for others, shooting well from the outside. I mean, he was just really, especially in the first quarter where he scored 19 points, with half of his 38. He was just, a wild man, I guess.
So I would say that a lot of the game is really aggressively anti-modern. Is that safe to say? It's very different.
Yes, I would say it's, it's like watching a different league, you know, in a sense. I mean, it is a different league because all the different players are different. There's different rules and so forth. It obviously has the NBA name, but, it would be like watching, even more different than college basketball is from the NBA. I think this is even a starker difference.
there's no 3-point line, obviously. I'm pretty sure nobody's listening to this and doesn't know that. And at some point when I was watching the game, I thought, why don't they just pack the paint? Why don't they just shove everybody in the paint? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then a few seconds later, it occurred to me, oh yeah, because they don't have, because zone defense is against the rules.
Right.
So I always feel like I always thought, like, oh, it's so weird that zone defense was ever against the rules. But when you watch old basketball, it really was completely necessary to maintain some spacing integrity at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. That's interesting, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's also just weird aesthetically just to not see the 3-point line like around. Like, yeah. It's just sort of, it's weird to watch a game and not see it there. I mean, the lack of use of it. I mean, I guess I've watched enough old basketball, like even in the early 80s when the 3-point line wasn't really used that much, where that part of it isn't so jarring, but just to not see the line, that still throws me off.
So there was a play in this game, very brief. Very odd, where third quarter, I think, Barry gets the ball at the top of the key.
Mm-hmm.
And they run, because I really, most of this game, very, like, does not resemble modern NBA basketball at all. There are a lot of outlet plays. A lot. There were probably 10 to 15 outlet plays in the game altogether.
Yeah.
Is that it? Mm-hmm. Tons.
I was thinking close to 20. I didn't count or anything, but yes, absolutely. And a lot of them end poorly.
Yes. Yeah. When they don't work, it's very like, I didn't even try that. But when they work, it's like, oh, why don't people do that more often? It's very odd.
Sure.
So there's a play in the second quarter of the game where Barry gets the ball at the top of the key, and he calls out a play. And the play turns out to be a high pick and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And so Barry runs across the pick. I think they keep him from driving, and he dishes it out to a corner shooter, and the shooter takes a three. And I thought, wow, that's a modern play. And that was it as far as watching things in this and thinking, yeah, that's what would happen today.
Yeah. There was very little use of, I mean, just not much pick and roll at all, really.
No.
And not really a lot of effort to get the kind of shots that we would think of as good shots, you know, in the paint. I mean, that effort was more like, that was kind of what the outlet passes were for, to get, you know, somebody, you know, close to the basket and get a good shot there. But for the most part, it's, you know, it's a league where, you know, you're looking for the 15 to 18 foot jumper.
Yeah, not even a lot of post-ups, I would say, in this particular game. I don't know if that's always the case. I you know, in old Blazer games, I think they post up Walton quite a bit. But
yeah, I mean, you would think that with Unseld and Hayes, they would have posted up more. And Unseld really struggled in this game, so maybe that just...
Yeah, Unseld was very bad.
Yeah, I don't know if that, you know, that may not have been his game. I think he was more... Yeah, I don't know if they set a lot of plays for him. And I know that, you know, Hayes was definitely, you know, more of a jump shooter than a big man than a post guy. You know, I don't really know enough about his game to really say. But yeah, it did, you know, it was an odd thing not to see at all. With Golden State, it kind of made more sense because I don't know if they really had the kind of players that, you know, were, you would want to do that. But, because I mean, their bigs were more just kind of like athletic energy type guys. It seemed like for the most part, like Clifford Ray would kind of facilitate a little bit in the high post. He would take shots, but he would just sort of like kind of, you know, hold the ball with one hand, palm it, and sort of like swing around and then, you know, dump a pass off to somebody. But other than that, yeah, I didn't really see they weren't really used in that manner.
So I would say that there are two players in the game who I think. I watched them, and part of this, I think, was that Unseld was just particularly bad in this game. Also, worth saying, Unseld, very Unseldy. As far as, like you don't look at Wes Unseld and think he's anybody but Wes Unseld. Does that make any sense? Yeah.
He has a distinctive look and, you know, maybe body language and movement.
He definitely,
you know?
He definitely got his midcourt stroll on once or twice.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he honestly, for a game that had so many of those outlet passes, I don't recall him having very many, maybe one or two, but,
yeah, it was
mostly
Elvin, I think.
Yeah.
Elvin really resembles a modern NBA player, kind of.
A little bit, yeah.
I would think to say, you know, he's big, self-apparently athletic, blocks at the rim, jump shooting. You know, he seemed like somebody who would translate almost immediately. I would also say the same thing for Rick Barry, but giving compliments to Rick Barry, I just can't even imagine.
Yeah.
That free throw shooting form, so obnoxious.
Well, you know, it got him 89% for his career, so it did work pretty well.
Do you think that when Rick Barry was on his, I mean, he lives on this particular high horse about shooting your free throws underhand. Do you think that people roundly rejecting it had to do more with, you know, oh, they just think that looks silly, or more with they just don't, you know, want to spend time with Rick Barry?
I think that probably has a lot to do with it. I also wonder if, like, it's really something you can just, like, pick up right away. Like, it's like, is it, like, worth the effort to relearn it, to shoot free throw shots when you have other, like, priorities in your, you know, it's like reinventing the wheel rather than just trying to kind of improve upon what you have?
I think for players who just nothing is working, that it's worth trying. I think Drummond should probably try it, but
it would make sense. But there has to be a reason besides, you know, not wanting to be around Rick Barry, or
that must be horrible, though.
Be embarrassed. But I mean, I feel like it's not like a technique you need Rick Barry to show you. You can just watch videotape and kind of pick it up, I think, you know, or have a shooting coach or whatever. Like, I think you could avoid being around Rick Barry. I think that's possible. I don't know about the, you know, whether it just would be effective. I mean, I imagine guys have had to, like, you know, maybe try it, like, privately and just go, this really doesn't work. So,
you know, I think for anybody who's, like, makes their money off shooting, it doesn't make any sense, because part of foul shots is probably calibrating your own shot a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like getting a feel for how the ball comes off your hands as a jump shooter. And another weird thing about Barry shooting his free throws underhand is that good shooter.
He kind of developed into one. He wasn't really a very good shooter early in his career. He had great form, though. He kind of reminded me a little bit of Dirk, you know, in some of those fadeaways.
Yeah. Another player who I would say looks pretty modern. I got curious, because he played in the ABA for a year. I got curious about whether he took threes or not, because, you know, he certainly had the form for it, but not really, just 3 of 10.
Yeah.
For his entire ABA career. And then he did play 1 year in the NBA with a 3 line, went 330, 73 for 221. It's pretty prolific.
Yeah. That does. Actually, he shot 73 out of 237 in his last year in the ABA. So because he played 4 years in the ABA. So
he did?
He did.
Oh my God, he did.
Yeah,
I feel very silly.
That's okay.
Boy, he went 19 for 86 one year.
Yeah,
really gunning.
He certainly was.
You need to get it together, Rick. Al Attles is the was the coach of
for
the
Golden
State Warriors.
I believe he's still with the organization. I think he's been there for like around 50 years.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, you know, I was reading about that the other day. I think he's just a Warriors lifer, pretty much.
Yeah.
In this game, he was wearing a collar that I would describe as aggressively open.
Yeah, I think that's good, yes.
Very, very open collar. That's all.
Open like the sea.
Rick Barry complaining about calls.
Yeah, and getting very frustrated with a few, like the kind of like temper tantrum-esque. Which is something he was kind of known for, which is another reason why he is pretty insufferable.
There is no way anybody, I don't know, I can't even imagine rooting for Rick Barry on a certain level. He, like, I remember at one point he takes his dumb underhanded free throw So dumb. It's so
You're really
dumb.
Anti-underhanded free throw, which it surprises me a little bit. But
you know, I'm not anti-underhanded free throw. I'm anti-Rick Barry's underhanded free throw.
Okay.
Maybe it has more to do with Rick, but you know, it almost certainly does. So he takes his dumb little underhanded free throw. Ugh. 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 And then he before it even goes up, he's like jogging back on defense, and I'm just like, narc. What a narc. You know it's gonna go in. Like there's not gonna be a transition opportunity. You don't need to hustle back on defense. What a narc.
He's like the kid who asked for more homework in school.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and that haircut.
Yeah. Just and he was balding it. He was balding at that point too.
Yeah. Yo, that is a straight up embarrassing haircut, Rick Barry.
It is very 1975.
Cause he's balding, but he also has long hair at the same time.
Yeah, it's like floppy.
And then he's like complaining about call. He loves. At one point, hey, I want to mention this. Elvin Hayes straight up flops at one point.
Yeah, there were a couple of flops in the game.
Yeah. But Hayes was like pretty flagrant, I would say. Like,
yes.
I think somebody was posted up on him, and he just immediately raised his arms in the air. No, absolutely no regard at all for, you know, fairness or anything like that. You know, we always act like it's such a modern invention, but. Nope.
Yeah, definitely not. And even Musburger and Oscar Robertson, who are the commentators, make note of it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know anything, as an expert on the topic, do you know anything about the Washington Bullets wiener dog mascot?
Tiny. No, Tiny was completely new to me here. I don't know where he came from. I know he's being held by Brent Musburger at the beginning of the event. And apparently he somehow was intending to give them some inspiration, the Bullets, but it did not work well for them.
Not at all. Yeah, they're the Washington Bullets in 1975 had a wiener dog mascot. It's not expounded upon for any reason. There's not a particular reason it's a wiener dog. It's just a wiener dog they liked.
Yeah. Is a wiener dog shaped like a bullet?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe a wiener dog is kind of Wes Unseld-y.
Okay.
Nah, because wiener dogs are thin.
Yeah, that doesn't quite work.
Yeah, that didn't work at all. It's really Elvin Hazy.
Apparently he pulled a miniature chuck wagon around the court during halftime and timeouts.
A chuck wagon?
Yeah.
Like what? Like a wagon with food?
I don't know exactly what a chuck wagon is, to be honest.
This was just a little dog that ran around the court with a wagon, and this was their mascot.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is done like University of Georgia football. They have a bulldog, you know, a real live bulldog, you know, who goes Uga, I believe is his name, who, you know, is around. So it's not completely unprecedented, but it is, you know, unusual for NBA basketball, or at least it seems unusual. Maybe this was going on all the time in the 70s. I don't know. We had Golden State was interesting to me because of just how young they were. Like five out of their top eight players are either rookies or first or second year players, which is like pretty, you know, unusual.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, that was the year where the Bucks and the Lakers had both kind of floundered, so the West was sort of wide open. It was kind of interesting to see who sort of emerged from that, and that sort of led to sort of because the late 70s are, in particular, there's not really like a dominant team that sort of controls, you know, either the East or the West. It's just, it's almost different teams every year, or, you know, different teams every couple years. Really, the Bullets are the only exception to that, because they made the finals in 75, 78, and 79, where, you know, every other year pretty much, you know, there's kind of a new team in there. So it's and that sort of reflects a little bit in the records, you know, of the next few years, where there are like the best teams have like low 50 win totals and the worst teams have like high 20 win totals for the most part. It's very much a league of parity for you kind of the rest of the decade until the Lakers become dominant in the beginning of the 80s.
So in every other NBA decade, everyone, it's safe to say that there is a dominant multiple recurring championships type team, right?
One or sometimes there's two, but yes, you can pretty every decade you can pretty much pick out one or two.
Do you think that is it safe to say about the 70s that it really is kind of the lost decade of professional basketball in a lot of people's minds?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that on Over and Back a couple times. We actually did a podcast on Rick Barry. That was our first episode. So, and one of the reasons why I kind of picked him is because he sort of fit, you know, his career arc almost entirely fits like between the Celtics dynasty of the late 50s to into the 60s and the and you know the beginning of the Magic Bird era. So he's just kind of in that lost period. I think it has a lot to do with the ABA being around as well, and you know taking some of the talent, and just and there's just a lot of expansion as well. They go from nine teams in 1966 to 22 teams by 1977. So there's just so much turmoil going on. I think it's harder for people to kind of wrap around the decade in their minds, where you can pretty much summarize the 60s and the 80s and the 90s, you know, pretty easily by just thinking of a relatively small amount of teams and players and, you know, years they won championships. Where the 70s, it's much more complex, I guess, just to kind of keep it all like organized easily in your mind. And I think that kind of does make a difference when you're talking about like what's remembered and what's not remembered in history.
Was Kareem still on the Bucks at this point?
This was his last year on the Bucks. He got hurt for like 20 games in the beginning of the season, and they went like 3-13 to start. And they also that was the first year without Oscar Robertson. He retired, so they were like a 38 win team. And he was traded right after this. This happened in May, I think, and then he was traded in June of 75. There's actually a brief mention near the end of the game where they speculate about Kareem going to the Knicks in a three-way deal involving Atlanta, which was a rumor at the time.
Because Kareem said Knicks or
Lakers,
and maybe he also said, or you, I was listening to your podcast about this the other day, and he said maybe or Bullets was a.
Yeah, there was some. I've read kind of mixed things on that because one of them said that Bullets were okay, and then another one was because there was an incident where there was violence at a home that he owned, where some people who belonged to his religious group were attacked there, and he had to have security around him for a while, and there was issues with that. So that sort of took Washington out of the picture, but that happened a couple years before this. So. That was sort of a weird. I guess there were just different depending on who you asked whether Washington was a contender or not. But I guess the Knicks were really the first choice. The last choice was the Lakers, of course, where he ended up going.
At one point in this game, during the broadcast, what they would do is that they would have the game playing out on the thing, and then they would have a little circle in the corner, and then the coach would be in that little circle.
Yeah.
And there's a very fun part. This is not something they could do today because there are definite sort of scouting related restrictions on what TV broadcasts can show of coaches. There's one point where Adels is in the corner and he's you can hear him talking, and then you see the action playing out on the court. And at one point Adels yells, "Go, go, go." And the down on the court, one of the players, whoever has the ball, I don't remember who it was off the top of my head. I really was not able to tell who any of the Warriors were. The Bullets, it was a little easier, but.
Barry, there's another white player who is roughly Barry's size who on the Warriors, so it kind of made it tough between them.
I believe his name was Bick Rary.
Yes, exactly. Bick Rary, yeah. Jeff Mullins. They also had similar. He was 23 and Barry's 24. So that I got a little confused between them and some of their bigs kind of blended together. Like Derek Dickey and George Johnson were roughly similar size, and Clifford Ray even. They were all kind of, you know, pretty tall, skinny guys, so they were sort of a little bit hard to tell apart. So I had some of the same issues of kind of figuring out who everyone was. I agree that the bullets were easier for some reason.
I'm part of it is that Unseld is he couldn't be anybody else in the world, but
yeah, and Kevin Porter, their the point guard, he's a pretty short guy, you know, he and has kind of skinny with long arms and legs, so he kind of stood out as just the body type.
And Shanier, I'm familiar with to a degree because he calls Wizards games,
right?
And also had the ball a lot. You know what the Bullets kind of reminded me of? This is very cursory. A little mm-hmm. Grizzlies-ish.
Okay. I can see that.
You know, there's sort of a bigger, skilled center. And there's a power forward who's, like, wider. Kind of rebounds. And then there's Shanier. I would say very Mike Conley. This is very arbitrary. Seems a little Mike Conley-ish.
Yeah, I would say Porter may fit that a little bit better than Shanier.
Oh. Well, all right. You told me, Jason. at the end of this game, the Warriors lose their the Warriors lose. The Bullets lose. They're about down 10. And Adels clears his bench. Well, the Warriors give up way before. It's sort of weird because they're only down 10, and I'm like, they're only down 10. But then I think about it a little harder, and I'm like, oh, that's like five possessions.
Yeah. Well, no, what was strange, though, is that, like, Washington, like, Casey Jones yanked the starters, all of them except for Shanier, and then ended up pulling Shanier out, like, with, like, between, like, 5 minutes left and 4 minutes left. And they were down, like, 12 or 14. But that's still, even without, you know, I thought the same thing, like, oh, well, there's not the three-point line, so it would be harder. But still, I mean, they actually cut it to 7 with 47 seconds left, and both announcers like, oh, that's not enough time. And I'm like, well, you know, like, you could foul them and try and put your starters back in. That's not, you know, you're going to be down 3-0. Like, it was just such a weird, like, I guess it was a desperation move just to try, like, okay, we're just going to put the young guys in and see what happens. But it was just such a... an odd thing to do. I mean, he'd be killed for that today.
Fouling for possession, I don't think didn't exist yet necessarily either. I don't believe, because I've always been under the impression that it was invented by Vivino, the NCAA coach, had cancer, died. The team that beat Hakeem,
Jimmy V, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that so? So that technique was that I mean, I don't know. I it surprises me a little bit because I feel like that would have been the tactic that would have been used before. But maybe there was a penalty. You know, the following rules have changed, and even in this, there's the, you know, they have the 3-for-2 where you get a chance to on certain types of fouls you can shoot. You get 3 shots to make 2 essentially. So maybe they, in those instances, they would have had that, and that would have made it not worth it to try it. But I don't know. It just, it just seemed odd.
So at the end of this game, Warriors clearing out the bench, cause it's not really, it's so weird cause it's only 7 and maybe part of it is possessions and maybe part of it is that people didn't foul yet. But, so clear out the bench and Steve Bracy comes in. And the CBS broadcast gets a picture of Steve Bracy, and underneath it says Steve Bracy - 12th man. And I thought, oh wow, poor Steve Bracy. Because Steve Bracy. Let's look into Steve Bracy's career stats real quick. Let's see how this guy did. Okay, 3 NBA seasons.
Yeah.
2 with Atlanta, 1 with the one with the Warriors would in fact be his last NBA season.
Yeah.
We're talking career averages of 6.1. Not doing much.
No.
But even then, in that moment, I feel even more for Steve Bracy now. In that moment, when I just saw that Steve Bracy was so 12th manny, that they just plastered it right across his face on national television. That poor man.
Yeah, but is it better that than not being mentioned at all? I mean, we wouldn't be talking about Steve Bracy, you know, almost 40 years later if he hadn't been put in, if they hadn't specifically put the 12-man graphic on there.
No, I guess not.
Let's see if Bracy played in Europe.
No. Steve Bracy.
That was it for Steve Bracy.
1972, 1974, Atlanta Hawks. 1974, 1975, Golden State Warriors. 6'1 guard, University of Tulsa. Oh, died at 56 from diabetes-related complications.
Ah, 2006. That's very sad.
Yeah, wow.
Poor Steve Bracy.
I didn't think that we were going to have to confront death here today.
He was inducted into the University of Tulsa Athletic Hall of Fame in 2000.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Hey, before he died from diabetes-related complications.
Yeah. So he gets a moment of glory here on the Biscast Ball.
To Steve Bracy.
Yes.
The Bracer. Anyway, so my last question before I leave. After watching this game, do you feel that the three-point line has ruined basketball?
I do not. No, I think the three-point line has been beneficial just to add more variety to the game and give teams a chance that might be behind in a score to get back into the game, so make the games more competitive. I don't have a problem with the three-point line at all. I'm generally a fan.
The fact that there's only one high-value shot on the court at any given time, it has consequences.
Yeah.
And a three-point line is almost more natural than, like, banning zone defense just so that you can maintain a semblance of spacing. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway. So, God, you know what? This Thanksgiving, I'm thankful for the three-point line, especially after watching this game.
I'm thankful that I got a chance to watch this game.
It's on you. Hey, if you want to watch it, Warrior 1975 Bullets at Warriors on YouTube. Just pop that in there; it'll be the first thing that comes up.
Yep.
I don't know. I don't know if I outright recommend it. If you like to see Rick Barry succeed, if you're that kind of sicko, all right. Go ahead. But otherwise, I'm not sure. Elvin Hayes is fun.
Yeah, there were a couple pretty neat highlight plays. Like Clifford Ray had a steal and a breakaway dunk that was pretty exciting. And then Phil Smith, like he juked Chenier and then dunked over.
Oh,
Elvin
yeah,
Hayes.
Yeah, that was really good.
Yeah, and Smith is, you know, like 6'2 or something. I mean, he's not a big guy,
that
but he went
dunk.
Up and yeah. So. Yeah, there were some. There were definitely some highlight plays. Actually, Barry had a cool behind the back pass later in the third quarter to Phil Smith. So there, I made a note of some highlight plays, and there is some of, you know, that kind of stuff as well that we didn't really address. But I think I like this game a little more than you did, and I don't have the outright vitriol about Rick Barry that I think you do. That might be an issue you may want to, I don't know, talk to somebody about, because it does seem to be eating away at you a little bit.
Like my therapist?
I mean, somebody. I'm not, you know, you have a podcast, so you can talk to whoever you want about it.
You know, look, I probably shouldn't say this. I have a little doll of Rick Barry I keep on my wall, and every morning I take a little pin and I slip it in there.
that might be a little bit too much.
Oh, really? And geez, this is not good. Jason, it was a pleasure speaking to you today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks to Jason. Once again, you can listen to him on the Over and Back podcast, also on the Hardwood Paroxysm Network. I apologize for the preponderance of popping peas on today's podcast. I do not own a pop screen. You can send me a message on Twitter at Corbina Smith, CORBINASMITH. If you have some leads or some opinions about Biscastball's ongoing campaign to get vampires out of the NBA, you can talk about it on the hashtag no vamps in the NBA. We encourage all discussion of anti-NBA vampire matters on hashtag no vamps in the NBA. I've decided to forego a poem this week. Instead, here is a public domain performance of a Rachmaninoff piece. Have a good week. Thank you.